Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What role have hunters played in human history, and how does this ancient method of acquiring nutrition fit into modern American life? My guest this hour has been fishing since he was 3 years old and began hunting just a few years after that. Today, his young family consumes only the fish and game he brings home from his trips to the wilderness, and he believes his direct participation in the process of selecting and killing the animals they will eat is a deeply respectful and responsible choice to make. Stephen Rinella has written for The New Yorker, Outside Magazine, and Field & Stream, and he hosts a TV show on the Sportsman Channel. His new book is called Meat Eater, Adventures from the Life of an American Hunter. Steve, welcome to Think.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
You write that there are fewer hunters per capita in the world today than at any other time in human history. What do we lose besides the taste of wild game when we buy our meat rather than killing it for ourselves?
One thing I think we lose is a connection, not just to food, but I believe we lose a connection to wild places. I mean, if you look at, like, one way I view human history is it's this kind of long story of the depersonalization of food acquisition. You know, I mean, since the agricultural revolution, we've just had people engaging in like specialization where we do specific things and let other people do other things for us. And one thing we've lost when we've given up hunting is we've lost that active connection to wild places. We've become something like passive observers of wildlife. Many of our relationships to wilderness and wildlife are really no different than watching documentaries on TV, where we feel that we're removed from it and we observe it. And I think that through hunting, what you gain is you can have an, you can play an active role in wilderness, an active role in the natural world. And if you behave properly, you can do so by having a positive impact on that and by leaving wild places and by leaving wilderness and wildlife in a better state than you found it.
You say you're most bothered by the increase in the number of people who are uneasy with the idea of hunting, as opposed to even the number of people who choose not to hunt. Explain that for us.
Well, you figure, like, right now we got in this country about 95% of American adults do not hunt, okay, are not licensed hunters. And it's difficult to count hunters because no matter what number you come up with, someone disagrees with the number because they'll argue that there's some kinds of hunting you don't need a license, and you have many children who go hunting with their parents, and they're not counted. But so give or take a percentage or two, 95% of us do not hunt. So the 5% of us that do live at the pleasure of those that don't. I mean, obviously, we live in a democracy. And if we, and if us, the 5% of us who hunt, don't live in a way and behave in a way that makes sense to non-hunters, they can just chip away at our rights and privileges through referendums and other legal and political actions. So we have to behave in a way that makes sense to them. If you have 95% of the people who do not hunt and 60% of those say, I don't hunt, but I get it. I understand why you do it. You know, I'm okay with it. I condone it. That's fantastic. But as that number grows to be like, I don't hunt and I don't like it, we're in for trouble. And I think that a lot of people who have high-profile positions in the hunting world foster this kind of like adversarial relationship with non-hunters. It's sort of a, it's us against them, you know, whack them and stack them kind of mindset that really is selling us short and isn't doing us any good in the long run.
Yeah, and so consequently, a lot of people have this perception that guys like you are out just for the thrill of taking the life of an animal.
I think that that's pretty true. More and more, I think that that's the case. You know, that image of the sort of barbaric person who's uneasy with his manhood, you know, out killing animals is put forth all the time through cartoons, and you see it in adult movies. I mean, you see it everywhere you turn. And it's a complicated thing for a hunter like me to address because I freely admit that I enjoy hunting. Hunting is thrilling to me. I like the adventure of hunting. And I also like the food of hunting. I would not hunt if it didn't mean food, and I would not hunt if it wasn't fun. Like, my hunting rests on those two things. But if I really just did get my kicks, as people might say, from killing animals, I would find a much more comfortable and efficient way of doing it than to put myself in questionable environmental circumstances where I'm really cold and at danger and often face an 80% statistical chance of failure in my pursuit of hunting. It just wouldn't make sense that that would be how I would choose to go around it. Another thing that people often say is like, oh, hunting, like they're just trying to prove their manhood. And it is like, that's actually an interesting argument. And in some ways I have to say that, yes, that's true. Because if you look at Native American cultures, Amerindian cultures, people around the world, it's often been considered a rite of passage to begin hunting on one's own. You might get certain emblems or hold a certain status in your tribe if you were to go out and kill a dangerous game animal on your own and bring it home to your people. So I can't deny that there is a sense of righteousness or a sense of pride, a sense of bravery that comes from doing some of the things that I talk about in my book.
Yeah, you write about the rite of passage, even for you, of killing your first deer, and it's something that you think a lot of young people who've grown up with hunting will relate to. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's funny because my first deer story, like what I would usually use for my first deer story is actually not even a kill. It was like my first deer miss stands out in my mind more than anything else. But the first deer that I did kill, it was a thing that I had been brought up to do. There was the assumption all through growing up that I would learn to hunt. I would learn to hunt by hunting small game like squirrels and rabbits, and that I would reach young manhood and I would graduate into killing a deer. And when I did kill my first deer, we took it home and my father did something that was sort of an unspoken tradition in our home. Is we took the heart, he would slice it up, dust it in flour, fry it in butter, and eat it with ketchup. So as unceremonious as that sounds, it was just like a thing we did, and it was a moment of great pride. Part of that pride, for sure, came from the fact that we utilized the animal. If I had simply gone out at that age, I was 13, I had simply gone out at that age, and I'd killed a deer, we'd all stood around and took some pictures of it, and we're like, wow, he killed a deer, and then walked away, the experience would have been nothing. It would have been a completely empty experience. But because we had that animal and it came into our home and we ate it, it was in the freezer, we would thaw it out, it was Steve's deer, you know, Steve's first deer, and we'd eat some of my deer. And if we ate the backstraps, we weren't allowed to put ketchup on it because it was disrespectful to the best part of the deer. And on, it turned into this cultural thing. Mm-hmm. And other kids that I grew up around were excited for when it would happen to them. And I think that it fostered in me a great respect for deer. You know, I knew about them. I wanted there to be plenty of them around. I liked watching them. And for all those reasons, I mean, that was kind of one of the many turning points in my life that I talk about in the book, where I put something together and I learned something about myself and about my culture.
Yeah, and you communicate this idea that hunting was not just a way to get food, although that was really important, but a source of bonding for you and your brothers and your dad.
It was a source of bonding between me and my brothers and my dad, and also in a way it became like something of a divorce between my brothers and my dad. And that takes a bit of explanation that I get into in the book. But when I was a kid, it would be a laughable notion that my dad would be going out into the woods or going out fishing and we were not invited. I mean, it would just never occur. Mm-hmm. We never had to go to school on our birthdays because we went fishing with our dad. It was like we never had to go to school on the opening days of the hunting seasons or the trapping seasons because we got to do whatever we want. We got to be in the outdoors. And if we weren't doing that, our dad would usually had us doing chores. So it was this one time when we had this thing we could agree on. And I grew up always hunting with my brothers. My brothers are now, they're each a year and a half older than me, you know, stepped up. They're still the main people I hang out with. And when we hang out, that's what we're doing. I mean, it's like our own, it's not our only way, but it's our primary way of relating to each other is having outdoor experiences. And as we got older, and like all, you know, most boys recognize this feeling. You get up in your late teens, and you start realizing that everything your dad ever said is wrong, and you know you don't want to be around him, and you have this kind of you know typical teenage situation with your dad. We kind of respond to that, my brothers and I, by becoming closer and hunting together more. You know, we would almost escape into the woods to go and have our experiences away from what we sometimes felt was sort of a overbearing home life in some respects.
Yeah, I want to talk about the development of your personal ethics with regard to hunting. And one of the things you write about, you say it's almost like religion. Like initially you sort of do whatever those around you have done. And one thing that you had to decide for yourself was whether or not you would use bait, which is something that I guess in your part of Michigan everybody did for a while.
You know what? When I was a kid, there's this town near where I grew up called Grant, Michigan. And it's really sandy soil there, and they grow a lot of carrots. We would go. I always tell people this; they never believe me, but I swear to you, we would go, and you could fill a pickup truck full of rejected carrots. So carrots that were misshapen, or too long, or too fat, or all kinds of problems with these carrots, and they would fill your truck for $5. And these are fresh, like, carrots. Like, we would sit and we would eat as many carrots as we could eat, and we'd even bring some home and save them. But primarily, we would dump them out in the woods and wait for deer to come find them. And you would take this pickup load, and we would drive out to one of the places we hunted. We would load up backpacks with carrots and backpack the carrots back in the woods and dump them. And anything that the deer were up to, okay, anything the deer were doing at that point in the year when people started dumping bait, they ceased doing. It rewrote deer behavior to have that much bait being dumped in the woods. So the trails changed, the deer's patterns changed. The deer had been subject to so much baiting that they knew it best to hit the bait at night, and so they would go kind of nocturnal. It sort of give them a heads up that hunting season was coming. Mm-hmm. And so you weren't so much hunting deer the way deer behave. You were hunting bait. I mean, it was like its own science and its own discipline, like how deer responded to bait. Now, looking back, it almost seems like a form of lunacy that we all participated in that, rather than just mastering the patterns that the deer were already engaged in and learning from that and going about it. As I say this, I'm not necessarily an advocate of banning baiting. I don't think it comes to that. I don't think that's really the issue. But for me, I don't think it fosters a sophisticated understanding of wildlife. You know, I think it just teaches you that if you dump a bunch of food out in the woods, things will come and eat it. And I'm interested in animals in a more nuanced, sophisticated way than that.
Yeah, talk about this idea of essentially a fair chase. What does that mean?
You know, people have struggled over the term fair chase for a long time. And I can't remember the exact quote, but there's a sort of a hunting theorist named Jim Posowitz, and he had this line where he says something to the effect of fair chase is a set of principles or codes that we live by that allow animals to generally not be taken, but for the hunter to sometimes be successful. And it's really difficult for us to point out how best to achieve that. But what we do is we have sophisticated patterns, very complex patterns of laws that govern hunting. And these laws might in some ways be looked at ethics, and they might in some ways be looked at pragmatics. If you allowed anything wide open, like let's say you said, okay, you can hunt deer at night with artificial lights, you can hunt deer with, you know, explosive projectiles, you can hunt deer from helicopters. What you're going to find is you're going to have a hunting season that lasts about 5 or 6 hours, let's say, and you're going to have a limited thing where they know it's going to be 100% success rates, so only a couple guys will get to go. But if you use, by imposing ethics through law, we allow it to be that we can have much more generous hunting seasons, much longer to hunt, because we know that the success rate won't be absolute. But for me, my own ethics go beyond law. I take things to a level of my own. I'm not just dictated by law. So I always adhere to the laws. I think we need to find our own ways to be comfortable with what we're doing so that when we do take an animal, we feel proud and we're glad to tell the story to others.
Stephen Rinella is with us. We're talking about his new book, Meat Eater, Adventures from the Life of an American Hunter. If you'd like to join us, call. The number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think Gone, KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Stephen Rinella. He's written for The New Yorker, Outside Magazine, and Field & Stream, among other publications. He hosts the Meat Eater TV show on the Sportsman Channel, and he's author of the new book, Meat Eater, Adventures from the Life of an American Hunter. You can be part of the conversation by emailing think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. So, Steve, the hunting that you describe in the book is very physical. It requires a certain level of fitness. You're climbing trees and running across tundra and getting in the water. Do you object to the term sport to describe hunting?
No, I don't, because I think that it's been used for so long that it kind of carries, you know, different connotations for different people. But I do look at it as more, like, on the surface, I might want to think that sport kind of trivializes something that is so ingrained and that has such a long history. Like, it implies, it might imply to someone like a frivolous activity, you know, mm-hmm. like he's out sporting around. And I wonder about at what point hunting went from being sustenance to sport. At the same time, I'll often describe myself as a sportsman. And when I say that to people who understand or to other sportsmen, we kind of know what we mean. So just one of those confusing terms that I could pick it apart and talk about all the ways it makes me uneasy, but at the same time, I'd have to point out that I do understand it. I think that blood sport carries a whole different meaning than mm-hmm. just sport as in sportsman. So yeah, it's a weird, what's the discipline where you debate meaning of words?
Well, semantics.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. It's one of those.
Talk about this.
It's strictly a matter of semantics.
Yeah, you write about the fact that you have stopped hunting with guys that you realize are not going to use the whole animal or who will shoot something and then ultimately have no plans to really eat it. I mean, how do you figure that out about people? And can you sort of tell by their attitude even when they're out there with you?
Yeah, it's something I'm suspicious of when I meet someone. I can tell what their motivations are. Often, just because I've hunted with so many people over the years. And a lot of times what will happen is, you know, I'll go hunting with someone. I mean, this has happened many times to my brothers. I mean, we talk about it all the time. But I'll go hunting with someone, and they've never hunted, and I get them into a deer, let's say. Then months go by, and I'm over their house, and I'll go and peer into their freezer and notice that the deer is pretty much sitting there in their freezer in its entirety. I'm just done hunting with the person. I might still be friends with them, but I would never help them get into another animal. You know, it just, they've violated something that to me is inviolable. It's just something you don't do. And kind of a funny story about that. This is, I almost shouldn't tell this, but my brother Matt, one time we were at this wedding. We were in a wedding party, mm-hmm. and the neighbors of the people that were getting married were out of town, and they said, "Oh, the guys from your wedding party can go stay in our house while you're gone." Mm-hmm. And my brother goes over there, and we're all staying there, and he opens the freezer, and this guy had some elk meat that was from 4 years earlier. And when my brother left, he took that elk meat home to eat it because he had determined that it was like an ethical dilemma.
Yeah.
Was stealing worse than letting that elk go to waste? And he determined that letting that elk go to waste was worse than taking it from its owner. I mean, that'll kind of demonstrate a little bit about how I feel about game waste.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, do you get tired of, I mean, an elk's a pretty big animal. Do you get tired of eating that every time you have meat for a year?
You know, I don't, because I do so many different things with game meat. And also, you know, I mean, you mentioned earlier, I have a hunting show, mm-hmm. you know, so I do quite a bit of hunting. And what I've done is, I've gotten together quite a network of people that really appreciate wild game, and I share with them. Yeah. Also, the guys that work on my show have all become wild game fanatics. Right now, my wife and I have a visitor, one of my wife's friends from college. She lives in Santa Barbara, California. She most certainly does not hunt. Her husband does not hunt. But I'll be sending her home with a cooler of meat because they have passed my test. You know, when I give them meat, they use it. Mm-hmm. And I also do something I like to think of as like venison diplomacy, where I have a lot of people over my home who are unfamiliar with hunting, uneasy with hunting, and I serve them game meat. And I've never had something like that happen and had the person walk away with a negative impression of hunting. They might come in my house and see, you know, I have a lot of skulls and stuff, animal skulls in my house and some rugs, you know, fur rugs.
Yeah.
No one comes in my house and sees the skulls and sees the rugs and says, man, I want to go hunting. But people come in my house and eat my food, they want to go hunting.
Mm-hmm.
So for all these reasons, I do that. But the diet I eat, even though it is wild game, is so varied in the ways I prepare it and the things I do for it. But no, I don't get sick of it. And also, it has like a spiritual meaning to me to eat my food. So it doesn't even really, to be honest with you, even if it did not taste good to me, I would just find a way to become accustomed to it and just eat it anyway, because I derive so much more mental pleasure from eating it than I do the physical pleasure of good tasting food.
I thought your writing about your relationship with your wife was really interesting. She is not a hunter, but she sort of got it and got your interest in it when she was breastfeeding your baby.
Yeah, it was kind of a funny. Like, the whole thing around having a baby was such a funny transition for us, because on the same, there was this trip we went on where I took her out to we have a place, my brothers and I own a hunting and fishing place, a hunting and fishing shack in southeast Alaska, and I took her out there, and she saw, the first time she ever saw a deer get killed, was out there, and I thought that we were, like, when that happened, she was so upset for a few minutes, I thought that we would get a divorce. I mean, she couldn't even look at me,
yeah.
You know what I mean? She looked at me like I was a barbarian, but she really quickly came to terms with it, you know? Like, she's like, she kind of thought about what that animal's life was like in the circumstances of its death, and realized that that life and that death were far preferable than the life of a lot of animals raised in questionable circumstances on farms and feedlots. You know, so she quickly made that connection when she thought about that. And it was on that trip that she first kind of said, you know, I would like to have a child. She would never point out those things as being linked, but in my mind, it was kind of like, I think she saw me and saw a relationship with some degree of clarity and came to terms with some aspect of our relationship and realized she wanted to, like, go a step deeper. But when we had the baby, she started stockpiling breast milk. Like, you know, I mean, you're producing more, I mean, far be it for me to start talking about.
Lots of women have more milk supply than, right.
Yeah, you're producing more milk than the baby's eating, and you're pumping it and freezing it. And she kind of had this little stash of these bags of milk with Jim's name on it and the date on it. And it was sort of mirrored the way I handle meat, with dates and labels. And she said, you know, I finally understand what it is with you in this stuff. Like, knowing you kind of made this and packaged it and it's tucked away and it's there waiting for you feels great. You know, and so those couple little instances that came out of having a child really affected our relationship.
Now, you do live in Brooklyn. Talk a little bit about just transporting what you do take home with you. How do you get it back into the city? Do you like butcher it on the kitchen table? How does that all work?
You know, I mean, you wouldn't believe some of the things that we do. So, in fact, I just came back yesterday from a hunting trip, and often I will butcher stuff in the field. Like, I'll break it down into primary parts. Like, we call it quartering, but it's not like, hunters call it quartering, but it's not quite quartering. But imagine you take a deer and you remove the forelegs, the neck meat, the back straps, inside loins, and the rib slabs. The only thing you have left really is like a spinal column laying there. Okay. So I'll take it to that point and I'll put it in bags and pack it out of my backpack, whatever. When I get into some town, wherever I'm flying in and out of, if I'm flying there to hunt, I'll go to a hotel or even in the back of a truck or whatever, and I'll get that broken down into pieces I can fit into plastic bags or Ziploc bags.
Hold on, the hotel, not in your room, right?
No, you know what? My brother lives in Alaska, and I hunt Alaska every year, and we just butchered a doll sheep in a hotel room. And then a week later,
it's like an episode of Dexter. How do you keep everything clean?
It's bizarre looking. And we'll put it right in the tub. And then I'll usually process it on the floor of the bathroom, put plastic sheeting down, and I'll process it on the floor of the bathroom. And then you got ice, because you're in a hotel,
sure.
You get ice. Or what I'll usually do is go around to a restaurant or two and check in with the guys that work in the back kitchen and say, like, hey, you know, this is going to sound weird, but is there any chance I could freeze this box for the night and pick it up in the morning when I fly out? And I always have good luck doing that. It might take a few shots, but you can do it. I've even done other weird stuff. Like, I've taken meat and wrapped it up. And then, you know, when you're in a hotel and they have the ice machine, dug down and just put it in the back of the ice machine. Like bury it, like wrapped up in bags and everything so it's sanitary, but put it down in the ice to keep it cool. And the only thing I've ever lost in my entire life is I've lost a few American eels one time that got lost. But generally I take it, once I get it frozen, I pack it into coolers and duct tape those coolers shut. And if you fill it to capacity with frozen meat, that meat will stay frozen for days.
Mm-hmm. So everything's...
And that's how I get around.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. My guest is Stephen Rinella. We're talking about his book, Meat Eater, Adventures from the Life of an American Hunter. Let's speak with Laura in Colleyville. Hi, Laura.
Hi. Steve, I really respect what you do. I have a question about people who hunt, but then later use their weapons inappropriately. And I was wondering, how do you counsel them? Like if you catch them using them maybe to herd animals or... to celebrate events like New Year's Eve, make noise with them. What do you say to them?
You know, that's a thing that it's depressing to think so, but I think that proper behavior around firearms is really best taught to people at a young age. When I was growing up, we had very free access to firearms. First, like 22s and later shotguns, but the gun, there was a protocol to it. You know, the guns lived in a cabinet and you checked to go get it, and it was not a toy, it was not a plaything, and it was just not something you messed with. You know, it was a food acquisition tool, it was a delicate, dangerous piece of equipment. I now try to act with some level of restraint, because there's something I was saying earlier about 95% of people don't hunt. And like I said a minute ago, we live at their pleasure. We exist at their pleasure. So anything I can do to dismantle stereotypes, negative stereotypes about hunters, I do it. And if that means not going out and blasting off a shotgun at midnight on New Year's Eve, I can do without that ritual.
Mm-hmm.
If it's going to make people uncomfortable or uneasy around me. At the same time, I'm not apologetic about firearm ownership. You know, I'm a gun owner. I have a constitutional right to own guns. I treat them respectfully, and I try to set a positive example, and I'll rear my kid up in the same way. But for other people that don't, I just think that they really need to look at what is most important to them. Is it most important to them to flash guns around, or is it most important, or is it more important for them to be able to go out and hunt on public lands under the guidance of laws meant to, you know, prolong that experience and meant to be able to enjoy that experience.
Laura mentioned, some irresponsible people that might deliberately hurt animals. And in fact, from your father, there was a lesson passed down. Even when it is absolutely inadvertent, he would go to extraordinary lengths never to leave a wounded animal alive.
Yeah, I mean, I sometimes think of wounded game as being kind of a dirty secret of hunting, and more particularly probably in bow hunting. I think there's a lot of game that gets wounded and unrecovered.
Is it harder to kill an animal with a bow?
Sorry?
Excuse me. Is it harder to kill an animal with a bow than with, say, a rifle?
Yeah, because when you're using a bow, you're missing something called like hydrostatic shock, or I mean, just the velocity and knockdown power of a bullet is not there with a bow. So it's possible to injure animals and not retrieve them with a bow. I think the one thing few people realize is how many animals get hit with a bow and live. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's just there's a big gray area between, you know, you might hit it and it might fall over right away dead. You might hit it and don't recover it and it could possibly die later. But quite often you hit it and it's a flesh wound and it's relatively unfazed. But we would never make that assumption. And we would scour the woods until early in the morning when that happened. A lot of people in the hunting world have chosen to just sort of to deny that this happens. You know, when you're reading hunting stories, watching hunting programs, it's just generally not covered that you'd have lost game. It's something that's glossed over. And people just out of a sense of, you know, out of a survival instinct, don't really want to discuss it. But, you know, I'll be frank with you, it is something that happens. It was something that's happened to me. It happened in our family. And I think that my dad set a great example by pushing us really hard to track animals and then go back in the morning and look more. And it was a somber event. if we didn't recover one. And granted, his motivation might have been how badly he wanted that deer. It might, his primary motivation might not have been a sense of responsibility to the animal, you know. But though I think it was a sense of responsibility to the animal and his desire to have the deer. But whatever his primary motivation, it instilled in me that sense that you work hard to recover your animals. And, you know, I still do it today. And it's like, it's a sickening feeling. It's a sickening feeling to wound something and lose it. And I try to avoid it at all times now by learning to be a better marksman, knowing when it's time to pass up an animal. You know, I let a lot more animals walk now when circumstances aren't right for a clean kill than I might have when I was younger and really eager to try to put them down on the ground.
Mm-hmm. It's like you don't have something to prove anymore.
No, I don't even know if it's so much I don't have something to prove. I just know now, I've seen enough now to know ways in which mistakes are made. You know, I think that's probably more than anything is like you just I have this like database of bad things I've seen happen or bad things I've done or questionable things. And now I just have I'm much more able now to see the outcome of my actions in a clearer way. And I don't look at things optimistically. If I don't have a good shot opportunity, like if I'm looking at an animal and it's just not right, something about it's not right. There's brush in the way. I'm not comfortable with the distance. Something about the animal's posture. The fact that the animal might be skylined, and I don't know what's behind the animal, I'm content now just to let it go. You know, I'll hunt more, I'll get another opportunity, and I'll know when it's right. And when it's right, it's gonna feel good to me, and I'll feel responsible, and I'll be happy to tell the story to others. It won't become a questionable story about a bad choice. And in my book, Meat Eater, I spent a lot of time, especially early on in the book, talking about some mistakes that I made that I regret to this day. And often those mistakes were just hasty decisions because I lacked a real background in ethics and was just trying to wing some things as a kid.
Stephen Rinella is with us. He hosts the Meat Eater TV show on the Sportsman Channel, and he's author of the new book, Meat Eater, Adventures from the Life of an American Hunter. Join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour has written for The New Yorker, Outside Magazine, Field and Stream, and other publications. Stephen Rinella is also host of the Meat Eater TV show on the Sportsman Channel and author of the new book, Meat Eater, Adventures from the Life of an American Hunter. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So I want to clear something up. You write in the book about being, a young teenager, middle schooler, and you and your brothers had this little business that you wanted to set up trapping muskrats. You mentioned that you brought toothpaste along. Can you explain what that was for?
Yeah. A lot of animals are attracted to smells that they would have no familiarity with. And I mean, you can understand this thing about the fact of how universally appreciated worms are among fish populations. Like, you can go to a river where the fish have no way ever eaten a nightcrawler, you know. Like, they just don't live around there. But you throw the nightcrawler in and they want to eat it. Just something deep down in that thing says, go eat that. Even though muskrats don't have a lot of exposure to spearmint-flavored toothpaste, they smell it and they want to get involved with it. Like, they want to it's a lure. Like, we call it a trapping lure. And some people would go get peppermint extract. You might just try toothpaste. You could try other things like vanilla. You know, there's wild peppermint growing around. There's definitely not wild vanilla growing around in Michigan. But you put a vanilla extract out and they want to come smell it. Or they don't know why. The same way like groundhogs are super attracted to molasses. It's just like I think that they smell certain signatures, you know, certain like It just means food to them somehow. So yeah, we would carry toothpaste and use it to lure in muskrats. Later, I got into more things more specifically focused to muskrats, like special muskrat lures and glandular scents. But when I was starting out, toothpaste, and equally unfamiliar to muskrats, apples.
Now, can you eat muskrat, or were those only for their pelts?
While I was tramping, I never ate a muskrat. And I had some guys that would want muskrats. Like, there's this guy that went to our church who would always ask me for a dozen good muskrats. Like, he wanted the back legs because he liked to make a dish that he had become familiar with when he lived in Louisiana. So he would want some muskrats. I would sell muskrat carcasses to guys who would feed them to sled dogs, because muskrat and beaver are favored sled dog foods. They would grind them up and feed them to the dogs, usually on race day. A lot of guys thought that a dog ran better on that kind of diet, so mm-hmm. I'd sell it to them. I would use muskrats for bait. But it was like when my older sister, you know, she had this job working in an ice cream store, and it killed her on ice cream. It's just I couldn't imagine eating a muskrat. And then later, when I was in graduate school and I hadn't trapped in years, I also was like, what would one of those taste like? And then when I would get the opportunity, I would start cooking up muskrat, and I would cook some, you know, various dishes like Haas and Pfeffer. And in fact, just this past February, I made a meal of muskrat Haas and Pfeffer that I got when I went out to run a trap line with a friend of mine who traps in Wisconsin. So, you know, it's just a perspective thing. I think if you're just swarmed by something all the time, it becomes less appetizing. But my trapping practices were generally, from a meat standpoint, pretty wasteful. Mm-hmm. You know, very wasteful from a meat perspective. You know, but then I was using the hides, and like guys will go out all day long and shoot rabbits and squirrels and keep the meat and ditch the hide without thinking about it. And I was engaged in sort of the opposite, selling the hides, ditching the meat.
Which is something you wouldn't do today.
It just wouldn't really appeal to me today. I've gotten older, and my relationship with animals has just gotten a lot more complex. And now, you know, when I take a life, it's for me to eat. It's just something I've arrived at personally. The other day I was out hunting, and you know, I was hunting antelope with a friend of mine in New Mexico. And this guy's family's been in New Mexico. My buddy's family's been in New Mexico since the time of the conquistadors. Hmm. You know, around this place, you're like, make sure to shoot the coyotes. Make sure to shoot the coyotes, because they run livestock. And every day we'd run into coyotes, and I didn't do it. You know, I'd look at them, and I'd be like, you know, they asked me, but I don't want to. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not in the mood right now to eat one. I don't really relish eating coyote, and I just didn't do it against their wishes. So, you know, it's like you're constantly in hunting. You're always involved in these little moral games, these little morality plays inside your head. And that's just where I'm at right now on it.
Do you think there's something inherently unethical about buying meat at, like, the grocery store?
Absolutely not. I mean, think about it like this, right? Think of all the things we do in life that we don't take control of ourselves, we don't do ourselves. Like, we don't process our own raw sewage. Mm-hmm. We don't fix our own cars. We don't build our own cars. We don't make our own houses, okay? We live in a specialized society where we pick some things we want to do, and we farm the rest out to other people. We task it out and source it. Now, I could hardly sit here in a home that I did not build, wearing clothes that I did not sew, and say that someone's hypocritical for eating meat they did not kill. You know, it doesn't make sense to me. But if someone does feel that calling, if someone decides that that's the thing that they want to take control of, and that's the thing they want to feel closer to, I'm all ears, and I'll embrace them and help them in any way I can. But if you take my own wife, who we talked about earlier, she has seen hunting. She understands hunting. Chooses not to participate in it. But that girl has eaten more wild game than 90% of the hunters I know.
Mm-hmm.
When we're eating at home, we're eating wild game. So, and she doesn't have any real problem with it. I mean, she almost kind of laughs it off. She's like, I have seen hunting. I choose not to hunt. I like to eat wild game because it's helpful for her when eating meat to know what the animal's life was like, circumstances of its slaughter. But it's not something she wants to participate in. What does bug me, or another thing that, let me first say another thing that does not bug me is someone comes to me and they're vegan. I really have nothing to say to them. I'm like, you've come to a very, you know, calculated response to things, and you have this moral code you live by, and it's not upsetting to me at all. But if someone is eating meat from a store and then acts as though they're against hunting, that's where I find trouble.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go back to the phones. We have Anthony on the line in Dallas. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say thank you for being such an eloquent, well-spoken person explaining your position pro-hunting. As someone in today's society who partakes in that pastime, I find it refreshing to meet people like you.
That's very kind, man. Thank you.
Absolutely. My second question is I oftentimes get in these moral discussions with people that are opposed to hunting who seem to be completely okay with eating fish or fishing and then eating the game that they catch. Just curious to hear your position on that and how it seems to contradict what we're doing as hunters in society.
Yeah, that's something I think about, and I kind of touch on that in my book as well. And I think that it comes from we have, as humans, I think we perceive this kind of gradation of creatures from being like essentially non-sentient to being sentient or like us. And if, to think of it in an extreme example, I think a lot of people, we would agree, would eat cheese, which is, you know, mold or has, you know, is a living thing, but would not want to eat a chimpanzee, which is our closest living relative. So I think that people fall in various places along that spectrum, you know. For me, yeah, like I hesitate to say it because it opens up, you know, I'm always sensitive to ways in which I'm, you know, the ways in which I'm inconsistent. But yeah, like I would not want to eat monkey meat because I just think of monkeys as being so, it's just so unappetizing. It's hard for me to picture them as an animal. And I think for other people, they might look at a squirrel in the same way and be able to eat a fish. I think about my own boy. He's 2 years old. I haven't taken him hunting yet. Because on the above my bed, above mine and my wife's bed, I have a set of moose antlers hanging on the wall. And he'll look at those moose antlers, and he'll ask me what that moose is going to eat. Hmm. And I realize he has no notion of it. But when I take him fishing, he already just views fish like he's okay with it. We'll catch a fish and we'll eat it, and he's fine with it. But he has a hard time accepting the death of an animal. And I need to wait another year or two, till he's 3 or 4, before I take him out hunting, because I don't want to startle him with it. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to wait so long that it startles him in another way, but I don't want to do it so early that he doesn't understand it. And I think that it's just something that people have varying sensitivities to it, you know. But I much more respect someone who just steps out of the meat thing altogether. They don't eat meat, they don't eat fish. I would happily have that person over to my house for dinner if they came out and just cook a vegetarian meal for him. Because I'd be like, you know what, you've arrived at a consistent platform for yourself, you know, and I admire that.
You have a daughter now too?
No, I got a daughter coming.
You have a daughter
coming.
My wife's
having a daughter in December. Yeah.
Do you want
it? Because when my wife, when we found out it was a girl, my wife who does, you know, likes to fish, does not hunt. The night we found out we were having a daughter, she made me promise that I would teach our daughter about hunting and fishing with the same level of enthusiasm that I use with our son.
That was going to be my question. Yeah.
Oh.
What if your kids don't like hunting and fishing? Would that be okay with you?
Oh, that's fine with me. You know, I mean, of course I want. You know, of course I want them to. And in some way, maybe this is hopeful, wishful thinking. In some way, I assume they will be, mm-hmm. because in my family, like the guys have just always hunted. But sadly, the women have not. My sister-in-law, my brother's wife, likes to hunt, but there's a big, you know, there's a absent, the women in our family just aren't hunting. So if I could turn that tide and have my daughter hunt, that'd be great. If they both just don't like it, their hunting and fishing is not like a prerequisite for my love. You know, of course I'm going to embrace them, whatever they want to do. I'll encourage them to do anything that they have talents and passions for. And then I'll be fine with it. I mean, it's like a changing world and people choose their own path. But yeah, I mean, if I could have my way, they'd be like really hard hitting hunters and fishermen. But that might be wishful. The thing that makes me worry more is some people laugh and they'll say, oh, it'd be so funny if your kids were into ballet. And I'd be like, you know, that'd be fantastic. I would rather that. I would rather the extremes than the middle ground. Like, I would rather them be a hunter or like into ballet than if they were just into soccer, for instance. Like I want them to be, you know, I just hope that there's like a bit of a fire there, you know, some passion there.
Hmm. Well, they could have a passion for soccer, I guess.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But the thing is, I wouldn't.
I know what you mean. Yeah,
it would be like going to the matches would be more obligatory than exciting for me.
So do you think that the laws that govern wild game predation are appropriate in this country? Do you think they're too strict? Do you think they're too lax? What's your take?
I'm constantly impressed at the job that the states do. And wildlife management is a responsibility on a state level generally. There's some federal oversight, but primarily state. I'm always impressed by the job that the states do. And I rarely question the validity of a state's decision on hunting and fishing laws. Right now, that's definitely the case. Mm-hmm. You know, things could change, but right now the states do a very good job. Oftentimes when there's something that I don't understand, you know, like some law that you don't get, like, oh, you can't hunt in some states on Sunday, you know. And you'd be like, well, how in the world would that happen? And you look and there's often some deeper cultural thing. Like a lot of hunting laws are meant to preserve tradition and heritage and like traditional use patterns. So in some states, like in the South, there's many areas where you can hunt deer with dogs. In the North, you can't hunt deer with dogs. Because in the North, a long time ago, people weren't really hunting deer with dogs. It just wasn't something that was done there. So there's some things that might seem arbitrary from state to state. But I believe the state fish and game agencies are generally very well guided. And they exist under mandates that they have to manage fish and wildlife resources for longevity. You know, it's not something that they're given to just piss away. And they do a fantastic job. There are mistakes made all the time, but in general, I think that if you're looking for an ethic, if you want to go hunt and you want to make sure you're doing things right, if you just go and follow the laws as laid out by your state, follow all applicable laws, you will almost unerringly be doing ethical hunting.
Last thing I want to ask you, we just have about 30 seconds left. What do you like to hunt in Texas?
You know, the things I've hunted in Texas have been quail, javelina, Barbary sheep or audad, and whitetail deer. And I think that the thing I like hunting most in Texas is javelina, though it takes a lot to make a javelina taste good enough to serve, for instance, to your in-laws. You really have to bring, you have to be on top of your game.
Extra ketchup.
If you're going to serve javelina to your in-laws.
Stephen Rinella has written for The New Yorker, Outside Magazine, and Field and Stream. His new book is called Meat Eater, Adventures from the Life of an American Hunter. Steve, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I love a chance to talk hunting with someone who, you know, asks the good probing questions. So it's great.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. If you want to know more about upcoming programs or download our free daily podcast, go online to kera.org/think. Email any comments, questions, or suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.